Hi, I'm Carolyn Beeler. I'm the environment correspondent and editor at The World. For the past several years, I've been covering what I see as the biggest story of our time, climate change. I've traveled to the face of a melting glacier in Antarctica. I've been in the room as world leaders hammer out agreements at UN climate summits. And I've seen cutting-edge carbon capture projects being built under the sea floor. I will never, ever forget sitting with a family in Pakistan who'd lost almost everything, their home and livestock and most of their belongings after catastrophic flooding turned their town into a lake. The story of climate change can feel really big and overwhelming, but being able to sit down and talk with people across the globe about what they're experiencing and how they're trying to help, that makes this story real and immediate. But we cannot do this work without your support. As we close in on the end of the year, we're aiming to raise $67,000, and we are counting on you to help get us there. A generous donor, thank you, has offered to match your gift one-to-one up to that $67,000. That means if you give $50, The World gets $100. If you give $250, The Newsroom receives $500. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation. That is theworld.org/give. I really can't emphasize enough how much your support means to our newsroom. Thank you. And now, on to the show.
The largest Jewish-Arab grassroots organization in Israel is not just trying to cultivate empathy. It wants a paradigm shift.
To really understanding that Jewish-Israeli safety is dependent on Palestinian freedom.
Our guest says they're fighting over the soul of our society. I'm Marco Werman, also on the show. 10 years ago, Ukrainians started a revolution that would topple their pro-Russian government.
Everybody was hugging, everybody was dancing, chanting, and singing Ukrainian songs. You know, there was, oh, I want to cry.
Since then, Russia has been striking back. And for this South African band, Ubuntu is a driving force.
We will not stop the gospel of give a hand to a guy that's going down.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us on this Tuesday. Leaders of Israel, Hamas, and the U.S. are all indicating an agreement could be reached soon that would release some of the 240 hostages held by Hamas since October 7th. President Biden told reporters at the White House earlier today,
"We're now very close, very close. We could bring some of these hostages home very soon. But I don't want to get into the details of things because nothing is done until it's done."
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is convening his special war cabinet and other decision-making bodies. The top commander of the Israel Defense Forces, Herzi Halevi, congratulated soldiers in the Gaza Strip today. He told troops that attacking Hamas on the ground creates better conditions for a hostage agreement. Israel has been bombarding Gaza relentlessly for 6 weeks, killing more than 11,000 people, with thousands more missing, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. On the possible hostage deal, senior Hamas officials outlined that an agreement could be reached soon, which would see the release of hostages in exchange for the freeing of Palestinian prisoners in Israel. As political and military leaders negotiate over the fate of civilians on both sides of the war, there are Israeli and Palestinian people who are working together to search for common ground. We're about to meet two leaders from Standing Together, the largest Jewish-Arab grassroots organization in Israel. They just returned to Israel after a week-long trip around the U.S., bringing a message of Arab-Jewish partnership. They are both Israeli citizens. Sally Abed is Palestinian and lives in Haifa. Alon Lee Green is Jewish and lives in Tel Aviv. We spoke earlier this afternoon. Fresh off your trip, Sally, what surprised you about the conversation around the Israel-Hamas war in the U.S. versus what you've been hearing in Israel?
I mean, a lot of things surprised us, but also a lot of things have been aligned with the divisive nature that we have here. A lot of people around the world, and especially in the U.S., just have a very personal connection and feelings about what is happening in Israel-Palestine, and coming from a very, very difficult moment, you know, to the U.S. and finding ourselves yet in another extremely divided, tense environment. We also saw the same pattern. So it was easy to navigate them and actually provide our insight in how to create the duality of the experience.
I mean, this is kind of the mission of Standing Together. Alon Lee, can you just tell us briefly about the impetus behind the organization? I know you founded it in 2015 after a very different sort of Israeli operation in Gaza. Can you remind us what was happening and what you set out to do with Standing Together?
Standing Together was founded after yet another war, the war of 2014 against Gaza and the people living there, and another violent escalation in 2015. It was two very bloody years where a lot of Palestinians lost their lives and Israelis lost their lives. And we looked at this war and we saw that our leaders were only promising us more blood and more hatred. And we said that there must be a different way, a way where Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish citizens of Israel are standing together, actually seeking an Israeli-Palestinian peace, a life where we can all live freely and equally and with independence.
I mean, October 7th feels very much like it's reset the stage for that zero-sum game again. Sally, most recently, were you working closely with Palestinians in the West Bank?
We organize citizens of Israel, both Palestinian and Jewish. However, we do collaborate with also cross-border organizations as well as Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank against the settler violence that they face on daily basis, that they are still facing. And right now, obviously, a lot of our work is within Israel, trying to amplify our voice, our joint voice, our joint humanity, but also saying a very, very political message. We're at a junction, a historical junction that is very dark, very painful, and we need to choose a way. And our way is peace, and not out of naivety, not out of saying that we need to be in this together, but really out of very deep, radical idea that there's no other way, and that, you know, maintaining a violent military control over millions of people is just not sustainable and will never be the way.
I mean, one can imagine how challenging that work is right now because of the divisions and, mm-hmm. and because the events of October 7th were so horrific. Alon Lee, you and your organization have had to pivot since October 7th. What kinds of activities is your group involved in now on the ground?
So the first responsibility we chose to take upon ourselves was the responsibility to bring the Palestinian citizens and the Jewish citizens together to really keep the safety of our society, to try and prevent from those who are in the very radical and extreme right wing to push our society into more hatred and violence and tension. So we created Jewish-Arab solidarity groups all across the country. And we also tried to monitor calls for violence and revenge and to prevent them, working with the police, working with the media, working with our activists to really de-escalate this moment.
Let me ask you about that, Sally, because, I mean, it's an understatement to say Israelis are in a deep state of trauma at the moment. Palestinians in Gaza under the Israeli missiles are also deeply traumatized. The pivot that Alon Lee was talking about once the missiles were flying in both directions and you're faced with many traumatized folks, I mean, is that working to bring people together, creating sort of universal empathy?
It really is much deeper than that. You know, what we are trying to say and portray is really shifting the conception and shifting the paradigm from zero-sum game to really understanding that Jewish-Israeli safety is dependent on Palestinian freedom. It's dependent on it. And it's really much beyond humanity and human solidarity, which is extremely important. And obviously, at the very first days, that's all we could have hold. You know, we are humans, and humans, when they are scared, when they are traumatized, it's very, very difficult to hold humanity of the other, right? But what we're saying right now is really very political message that really understands that we will never have safety. We will never actually have sustainable, safe future if we're not all equal.
In this fraught moment, though, are you finding a lot of citizens in Israel willing to give up that zero-sum game attitude?
One, we don't have the privilege to give up on the humanity or the morality or, you know, whatever you want to call it, of the Israeli public. We are fighting over the soul of our society and how it actually will look like. This is a defining moment, and we need to do it as Palestinians and Jews together.
Alon Lee, I mean, there does seem to be so little overlap in how many Israelis and many Palestinians understand this conflict. With so few shared facts and so little trust, how do you start or continue a conversation about partnership in this particular moment?
It is very difficult. The emotions are very strong. People are really afraid, and we understand this fear. So the first thing we do is not preach, is not taking the moral high ground and you know, talk to people from a place of being or feeling better than others. We are not. And we're trying to meet people in their emotional place and to really try and build a conversation from there. Yes, we are afraid, but also people on the other side are afraid. We're talking about the fact that we don't want to leave our home. Other people don't want to leave their home as well. But it is difficult. It is difficult because people with a lot of power, with a lot of influence, coming from the far right, there are ministers, there are parliament members, there are people with a lot of followers in the media. They're trying to push our society in the opposite direction. They're, you know, coming to the 8 o'clock news every evening saying that the children in Gaza today are the terrorists of tomorrow. So there's no innocent people in Gaza, they claim. And we need to battle it. We need to fight this. We need to win, you know, the war over our society. It's almost illegal at the moment to demonstrate or to do political activities in Israel. The police even says if you want to rally in support of Gaza, we'll put you on a bus to Gaza. And that's a real quote of the chief of the police. So we need to be able to operate. We do it in a very delicate way, in a very complicated way, but we're not going to stop. It's the only possible way we have.
Sally, based on your and Alon Lee's experience in the U.S., so divided, was that trip something of a training ground for how to proceed in the Mideast with those conversations? Like, what did you learn about how to start a conversation or how not to start one?
Absolutely. I think just like we are trying to find the new way here and trying to challenge the binary, trying to challenge the paradigm and the conception, I think the American left needs to do the same thing. If we are going out of that assumption that we have equal rights for existence and freedom, and that we are both there to stay, no one is going anywhere. If we go out of that, then we will be able to shift the paradigm and the conversation and really overcome this polarization.
I think about the vocabulary of protest here in the U.S., terms like genocide, ethnic cleansing, or apartheid to describe mm-hmm. Israel's policies in Gaza, or you know mm-hmm. phrases like colonizing colonizers. I mean, you don't use that language. Or, like, I mean, how do you answer the question in this extreme moment, mm-hmm. who was there first? I mean, do you answer, do you mm-hmm. use any of this language? Do you address any of that?
We don't use that language, not because we don't acknowledge, you know, the decades-long systemic oppression of Palestinians and really the power differential. You know, we acknowledge that. But I do think in a lot of the times from the left, there is an escalation of terminology, right? Like you said, of trying to explain the situation in Palestine, which comes sometimes from also a lot of pain, a lot of frustration, and a lot of, let's say, lack of tools to actually navigate this hegemony. There is, and we acknowledge it. With that being said, and that's a very important point, a very important disclaimer, we don't think that kind of conversation should be the one leading us right now towards a solution and mm-hmm. towards the very basic fact that we need to stop the bloodshed. And our vision and our desires and our interest is to live safely and equally. Both peoples. And that's where we should start from.
Alon Lee Green and Sally Abed are leaders with Standing Together, the largest Jewish Arab grassroots organization in Israel. They just returned to Israel after a week-long trip around the U.S., bringing a message of Arab-Jewish partnership. Sally joined us from Haifa, Alon Lee from Tel Aviv. Thank you both. We are grateful for your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Still ahead this hour, a critical time to act on climate change. Improvisational musicians from South Africa, and up next, 10 years since a pro-Western movement took over in Ukraine. You're listening to The World.
The news can be disorienting, and it can be really hard to remember how we got here. That's why we started the Throughline podcast. Every week, we take you on a cinematic trip into the past to better understand the present. Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Today, Ukraine is celebrating 10 years since the start of the Maidan Revolution, a brief but powerful uprising that led to the downfall of Kyiv's pro-Russian government and closer ties with the EU. It also sparked a new wave of aggression against Ukraine from neighboring Russia, and that, of course, culminated in the full-scale invasion nearly 2 years ago. The World's Daniel Offman reports on how the Maidan Revolution is being remembered in Ukraine today.
Today in Kyiv, Ukraine's government held a ceremony to mark the 10-year anniversary since the start of the Maidan Revolution. Led by President Volodymyr Zelensky, they gathered at a memorial built for protesters who were killed during what many call the Revolution of Dignity. Later, in a video address, Zelensky tied the events of 10 years ago to Ukraine's struggle today.
І тоді фактично відбулася перша перемога у сьогоднішній війні.
He said that the Maidan Revolution was when, quote, the first victory in today's war took place. Back then, a majority of Ukrainians were eager to join the EU. Ukraine's president at the time was expected to sign an association agreement that would strengthen the country's relationship with the West. But it didn't quite go that way.
The president was pro-Russian guy, Viktor Yanukovych, and the very day he was supposed to sign the agreement, he stepped back saying that Ukraine is not going to sign such an agreement.
This is Alexander Kribet, a journalist with the Kyiv Independent.
And of course, people were angry because, like, it's the kind of aspiration of at least two generations of Ukrainians.
In Kyiv, people took to the streets. The biggest demonstrations took place at Maidan Nezalezhnosti, or Independence Square, and soon spread across the country.
These protests were violently suppressed by the riot police, and then more and more and every day more people were coming, and the protesters started to demand the resign of all the government, and of course the Yanukovych resign.
As weeks and months passed, protesters started camping out on Maidan Square. And it was no longer just about joining the EU. Demonstrators were campaigning against government corruption and the heavy influence of Russia. Soon, the size of the demonstrations ballooned from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands. Riot police clashed with protesters. More than 100 demonstrators died, and many more were injured. Finally, in February of 2014, Ukraine's pro-Russian government buckled, and Viktor Yanukovych fled the country. Here's journalist Alexander Kribet again.
It was insane, you know. It was such a joy that he fled. Everybody was hugging, everybody was dancing, chanting, and singing Ukrainian songs, you know. There was, oh, I want to cry. Sorry. I didn't think I'm so emotional after 10 years. Sorry. It was just great.
Since the revolution, the country has been led by pro-Western leaders. But at the same time, Russia has been wreaking havoc. Soon after President Yanukovych fled, Russia illegally annexed Crimea and started the war in eastern Ukraine. And of course, almost 2 years ago, Russia launched its full-scale invasion.
Ukraine achieved a lot for this decade. We got that EU agreement. We boosted our civil society. We boosted our state of minds. But the war is not over yet.
Kribiet believes that without the Maidan Revolution, Ukraine as we know it today wouldn't exist. But he also says that for half of his adult life, Ukraine has been at war. And he doesn't wish that for anyone. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Boats carrying more than 500 Rohingya Muslims landed on beaches in Indonesia over the weekend. They're among more than 1,000 Rohingya refugees who've arrived there in recent days. More are expected to come. The Rohingya face brutal persecution in their native Myanmar, and many will board rickety boats and travel more than 1,000 miles to escape. But this time, the Rohingya refugees are facing local resistance as they come ashore. The World's Patrick Wynn is following this story. What condition are these Rohingya refugees in, Patrick, after weeks at sea, and they're turning up now in Indonesia?
They're showing up hungry, thirsty. A lot of them are sick. There's a lot of women and children. They're in really rough shape, and the boats are just crammed in as tight as they can be under the hot sun. And the boats are landing in Aceh. That's the far western tip of Indonesia. In these communities, people usually follow a code of the sea. If you're in bad shape out there, they'll pull you ashore. And in the past, they've done that for Rohingya boats, but this time they're not receiving a very warm welcome.
Yeah, so how are these refugees being treated by locals when they land?
Well, in some cases, they're struggling to even reach land because local fishing boats will go out and push them back, with the locals saying, look, here's a little bit of food, but you got to keep it moving. You can't land here. Aceh is not a rich place, especially in the current economy, and they can't afford to feed thousands of people. Also, the Indonesian government doesn't want the fishing communities to be hospitable. It has, in recent years, jailed fishermen for helping Rohingya boats come to shore, treating Good Samaritans like criminals. And Indonesian officials are now saying, stop coming here. We are not a, quote, permanent solution. I spoke to Habibullah with an activist group, the Arakan Rohingya National Organization. He's an activist with them. And he said the Indonesian government has no choice. They have to step in and help these refugees.
They should save any human being's life, regardless if it is Rohingya or non-Rohingya or any other human being. This is our moral duty to do that.
And Marco, the latest is the UN is now on the ground helping people out, but the next steps are pretty unclear.
Patrick, it seems this Rohingya push to flee Myanmar is ticking up again. What's driving this influx of Rohingya refugees fleeing now?
Well, the first factor is weather. It's the end of monsoon season in Southeast Asia, so people just have better odds of surviving a 1,000-mile journey on the sea without their boat sinking. And then the other factor is there is still no political solution in sight. Rohingya have been killed or pushed out of their homeland in Myanmar by the military there. The UN calls that purge genocidal. And most are stuck in neighboring Bangladesh in, frankly, pretty wretched camps there. There's no dignified future. So they get in a boat and they take their chances, and no international coalition is coming to their aid. Habibullah, the Rohingya activist, told me that on the world stage, the Rohingya crisis is getting edged out by other conflicts.
In Ukraine, Israel, or Palestine, all are human beings, and we are trying to keep this Rohingya crisis in the front line, but we are not successful every time.
Patrick, we're seeing reports that in Myanmar, the homeland of the Rohingya, there's an armed pro-democracy resistance, and it's making strides towards toppling the country's military regime. I mean, you've reported on this for us. If the regime falls, does that help the Rohingya?
Maybe, maybe not. The group fighting the military regime in the coastal area where the Rohingya are from is largely Buddhist. There is lots of ethnic and religious tension there. So yes, most Rohingya would celebrate if the military regime fell, because that's who has tormented them. But there's some skepticism about whether or not that would solve all of their problems.
The World's Patrick Wynn, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories
as we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Historically, eyeliner has been more than a cosmetic.
In ancient Egypt, it was actually used to honor the gods, to ward off the evil eye, to protect from the glare of the sun, and also to treat the eyes medicinally.
Our guest tells us the aesthetics are also alluring.
One thing I tend to say about Nefertiti is that she's the original beauty influencer.
Right up to Amy Winehouse, ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Germany is seen as one of Europe's most welcoming nations for asylum seekers and refugees. During the 2015 migrant crisis, more than a million people fled there. Former Chancellor Angela Merkel famously said, "We will manage," when asked how Germany would cope with the large number of new arrivals. But state governors now say they can no longer manage, and the German government is considering more hardline tactics. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
7 years ago, when thousands of refugees stepped off the train at Frankfurt's main station, this was the sound that greeted them. Locals held up placards that read, "Welcome to Frankfurt," and they handed out care packages to the exhausted new arrivals. This year, though, it's different.
We're at the limit of our housing capacity. We couldn't accommodate any more people. We just don't have any available living space.
This is Elmar Schroeder, speaking through an interpreter. He's the mayor of Diemelstadt, a small town in central Germany. Schroeder told Deutsche Welle TV recently that the language school in his town also doesn't have enough teachers to cope with the increased numbers of refugees. Around 240,000 people have applied for asylum in Germany so far this year. That's a far cry from the numbers that arrived in 2015. But Germany has also taken in more than 1 million Ukrainian refugees since Russia's invasion last year. And Mayor Schroeder isn't alone in his frustration. Several state governors have been complaining that the German government isn't doing enough to help them cope. Earlier this month, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz made a deal with those governors. Scholz called the deal historic. It includes more money for local municipalities and a series of measures aimed at turning migrants off coming to Germany, like enforcing more border controls and restricting cash benefits to asylum seekers. But migration experts say it's unlikely to make much of a difference.
We have had periods where asylum seeker benefits had been cut back even further than they are right now. And still, that did not really stop migration to Germany.
Danielle Kasparik is with the Migration Policy Research Group at the University of Hildesheim. Kasparik says anti-migrant rhetoric has ramped up in the last couple of years. And it's not just far-right politicians who are at it.
Things that would have been considered racist or impossible to say are now being stated by a number of politicians from very different political parties.
In September, Friedrich Merz, leader of the Christian Democratic Union, that's former Chancellor Angela Merkel's party, said Germans were going crazy, seeing large numbers of unsuccessful asylum seekers still getting help from the state. They get full benefits. They get full medical care, Merz said. They sit at the doctor's office and get their teeth redone, while German citizens next door can't get an appointment, he said. The German Dental Association said they hadn't heard of any appointment backlogs caused by migrants wanting to get their teeth done. But attitudes among the German public towards asylum seekers is reported to be changing. One recent opinion poll said 2/3 of Germans see immigration as a major problem, and asylum seekers themselves are noticing that change. Karl Kopp is with the German refugee rights group Pro Asyl.
Now, in 2023, we have already 1,400 attacks against refugees and 112 attacks on shelters.
The anti-immigrant party Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD, is also doing well in the polls. And Kopp says that might partly explain why Olaf Scholz and his government are also considering another controversial proposal to send asylum seekers to another country, possibly in Africa, to have their claims processed there. Like the Rwanda policy, Britain has been trying and failing to implement. Kopp says no one would have believed that Germany would even contemplate such a move just a couple of years ago.
Germany is a key player in the field of refugee protection in Europe. So if we lose this very important willing state, then it will have a very negative impact concerning refugee protection in Europe. And this development will also have a very negative role model effect in the world.
It's not all bad news, though. In southwestern Germany, the town of Ostelsheim elected a Syrian national as mayor earlier this year. Rian Alshabel fled Syria in 2015, making a harrowing boat journey across the Mediterranean from Turkey to Greece.
Da als die Wellen richtig hoch geworden sind und die
Almost all the women and children were screaming as the waves got higher, he told Al Jazeera a couple of months ago. I wondered what it would feel like to die by drowning, he said. Today, the new mayor finds himself in the position of trying to provide for asylum seekers in his town. He says he sees the issue from both sides now. A German radio show asked Al Shabel this month if he noticed local attitudes in his town had changed towards refugees. It varies, Al Shabel says. There are those who see the issue increasingly as a burden, but many others see it as a challenge, the new mayor says, and it's one we have to work together to overcome. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
They have blocked roads, stormed red carpets, splashed tomato soup on a Van Gogh painting, all in the name of stopping fossil fuels. For over a year now, the British activist group Just Stop Oil has been using what it calls a disruptive campaign strategy to pressure the UK government into stopping to issue new licenses for fossil fuel projects. Fossil fuels are a major cause of climate change, of course. But are these disruptive tactics working? Reporter Rebecca Rossman spent some time following campaigners around London to find out.
Traffic has come to a standstill on this two-lane road in southwest London. Not because it's rush hour. It's actually nearly 11 a.m. It's because a group of more than 60 people in orange vests have stepped in front of traffic to begin what they call a slow march. It's one of Just Stop Oil's latest disruptive tactics aimed at pressuring the British government into stopping fossil fuel production. Irritated as these motorists may be,
the evidence from the research and social history tells us that nothing else really cuts through.
That's Zoe Cohn, who has been a spokesperson for Just Stop Oil since the group was founded in February 2022. She says the activists involved in these campaigns are using disruption as a last resort.
Because all the stuff that we've done for years, the signing petitions, etc., doesn't make any difference.
Cohn says these actions, on the other hand, work. She tells me about a recent similar disruption that took place in the Netherlands. After weeks of hundreds of activists blocking a major road near The Hague, the Dutch government last month agreed to discuss solutions for phasing out fossil subsidiaries. About 15 minutes into the slow march here in London, police arrive and urge protesters to move onto the sidewalks. Not a single demonstrator budges. Some give a scattered applause. But that's when the honking bystanders become more agitated. One man gets out of his van.
Yeah, you're blocking every normal person, people like me, yeah, that I can't stop it.
That's Danny O'Connor, a FedEx delivery truck driver. He says he understands protesters' concerns about the climate, but there's nothing he and other drivers being interrupted can do about it.
I mean, I'm trying to go about my normal day, do the normal day's work, And these people are stopping me. I'm normal.
If the activists want to make change, O'Connor says, they should take it up directly with the people that can put an end to it. He's not alone in his thinking. A YouGov poll released over the summer found that 64% of the public held an unfavorable view of Just Stop Oil. On top of that, the British government said in July that it would issue hundreds of new oil and gas licenses in the North Sea, suggesting campaigns like this are still a ways off from reaching their desired impact. But Benjamin Farrer, who teaches political science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, says it could just be that it's too soon to judge the relatively new movement's success.
There is evidence that activism works, that social movements can have a profound influence on government policy. It doesn't happen quickly, but it does happen.
Farrer has spent a lot of his research tracking the success of environmental movements.
And what I found was that in countries like the US and the UK, it's really difficult to use elections to make your voice heard. This type of activism isn't happening because of some personality flaw among environmentalists. It's happening because the normal democratic channels are broken.
Asking nicely is what I was doing.
That's Patrick Hart, a 37-year-old doctor participating in the slow march.
I was writing letters and signing petitions for a long time, trying to do it the normal way. But history shows us the only way you can break through with the truth in a short space of time is to disrupt.
Shortly after we speak, Hart is arrested along with dozens of other activists who are peeled away from the road and placed into vans. Campaigners are used to this. Some have been arrested more than a dozen times. Watching all this unfold from the sidewalk is neighborhood resident Di Bridges. Bridges says she has sympathy for Just Stop Oil's cause, though she's not sure it's a way to win over the masses.
Because this doesn't make the message get to enough people.
And even the people who do hear it, she's not sure they understand it. But it is a sign, she says, that something about British democracy is broken. People deserve to be heard, she says. And until we figure out how to let that happen in a fair way, we'll be stuck at an impasse. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in London.
BCUC is the name of a band from South Africa. It's an acronym that stands for Bantu Continua Uhuru Consciousness. Their sound is a primer on music and culture in South Africa today. The members of BCUC are based in Soweto and Johannesburg. They sing in all 11 official languages of South Africa. Their influences come from just about every musical genre, from hip-hop to gospel, from rock to Afrobeat. BCUC is on a tour of the U.S. at the moment, sponsored by the State Department Center Stage Program. Zitulele Jovi Zabani Nkosi is lead singer and joins us from the road in Boston. Welcome.
You, what's up? It's Jovi from BCUC.
It's our pleasure, Jovi. You know, I've been following your music for several years now, and I just found out that one of the main philosophies when BCUC first started 20 years ago was to be a true band where everyone has a voice, a band where there is no band leader. Everyone contributes equally. How has that worked out?
It's working out very well. It worked out better than we thought. You know, like, there is more than just the guy who's singing and talking. We identify each other's strengths and see where you can help in the band.
Yeah, I mean, I ask because it seems like every musical ensemble, sooner or later, there has to emerge somebody who is the leader simply to keep things organized, right? And I think about your new album, Millions of Us. The songs are so expansive. The title track is 20 minutes long, broken up like a suite or a song cycle. What I want to know is, as a decentralized group of artists with no leader, how do you construct a concept album like this when there is no singular voice?
We are led by the vibe. We are led by the feeling.
Is that inspiration kind of a form of improvisation?
Yes. Like, we rely a lot on improv because, like, in every album that we have, probably 60 to 70% of it is improvised.
Yeah. So as I said, Jovi, BCUC sings in all of South Africa's 11 languages. When you combine that with the improvisation, what is the music saying? And how does it kind of give us a window into South Africa's multicultural society?
South Africa is beautiful to look at. South Africa is beautiful to live in. It's got layers that are visual and not visual. The living gap is getting wider.
The cost of living, the gap for those who have and those who have not, yes.
Yeah, like it's, yeah. It's getting wider. And South Africa was not designed like that, you know, like Nelson Mandela used to talk about Ubuntu, you know. Ubuntu, it means like I am because you are.
Hmm.
So in South Africa, like we grew up in the world of sharing, but the new world is saying stop sharing. We are trying to get that back on track. We will not stop the gospel of give a hand to a guy that's going down. We will not stop the gospel of it's possible for us all, you know, you just need to dig deep, you know.
Let's take it back to the music, Jovi, and the sounds on the new album, Millions of Us. What does the title refer to? And like, who is the us in Millions of Us?
It's us. It's all of us. It's the us, the band. It's us, our ancestors, everyone, you know. So for us, Millions of Us is that.
You've probably seen that critics have pointed to a shift in the music of BCUC from Afro-psychedelia to Afro-futurism. I don't know how you feel about labels, Jovi, but what do you make of those observations? How is BCUC actually thinking about its own kind of art right now?
We really don't think. We are the band that never plays the same show twice. We just know that whatever the audience we have in front of us, we're going to play for them and give them everything that we have and curate an experience and an atmosphere that even us have never experienced before.
Zitulele Jovi Zabani Nkosi is the lead singer of BCUC. Don't miss out. The band wraps up its U.S. tour in the coming week. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. There is more to eyeliner than meets the eye. That is a case our next guest makes in her new book, Eyeliner, A Cultural History. Journalist Zara Hankir reveals how it's been used across cultures as more than a cosmetic, something to protect and empower those who use eyeliner. She spoke with The World's Carol Hills.
Zara, you did some serious research for this book. What's the earliest example of the use of eyeliner that you found?
Sure. So eyeliner originates in ancient Egypt, where it was known as kohl, and it was used for purposes that go far beyond beauty, as you mentioned. In ancient Egypt, it was actually used to honor the gods, to ward off the evil eye, to protect from the glare of the sun, and also to treat the eyes medicinally. But I will say it did play a significant role in making people look more attractive.
And when you say kohl, you're K-O-H-L, not C-O-A-L.
Correct. It's K-O-H-L. And it's important to note, actually, that this material was made from natural substances. So it's not at all like Western eyeliner. And those materials could be things like mineral or soot. And oftentimes, kohl can be made from substances that people might be able to even find at home, such as nuts or plants. And what would be done with those materials is that they would be burned and you would take the soot from the burning, and then that would be the darkened pigment, which would then be applied to the eye. So what makes coal so different, besides the fact that it's used for purposes beyond beautification, is that it is made with natural substances.
Now, you mentioned ancient Egypt, and in your book, you talk a lot about a famous user of eyeliner, Egyptian queen Nefertiti. And she's someone you idolized as a teen. And I wondered what it was about her that captured your interest back then.
Sure. So I grew up in the UK. I'm Lebanese, but I have Egyptian heritage as well. And I think I was always looking for something that connected me to my culture, knowing in the UK that I was quite different to everybody else and also being made to feel that I was quite different to everybody else. And my father was quite obsessed with Egyptology. So he'd have magazines about ancient Egypt around the house. And I stumbled across this picture of Nefertiti. And she was so transfixing. And I think many people still find her transfixing today, in that she had a very striking, regal look, a perfectly symmetrical face, very high cheekbones, a very tall crown. And I think what's most important here is that her eyes were lined with coal. And therefore, she kind of seemed to be quite beguiling and alluring. And I think I always, in a way, felt that I could connect to her because she connected me to something far bigger than myself.
The way Nefertiti used coal or eyeliner, it continues to resonate even to today. And you mentioned that. Give us some examples of people in recent years who've kind of used the same look.
I think Nefertiti's classic cat eye look has been kind of ubiquitous in culture for the past 100 years, especially in the West. I think one thing I tend to say about Nefertiti is that she's the original beauty influencer, whereby when her bust was discovered, our interpretation of her beauty is from her bust. And when her bust was discovered and later displayed in Germany, people clamored to kind of emulate that beautiful look. And one of the ways that they were able to do that was actually by buying eyeliner and by lining their eyes with that eyeliner. And cosmetics companies kind of caught on and started marketing eyeliner within the context of being able to channel that exotic beauty. That was part of a form of fetishizing Nefertiti, and it was also part of what you would call Egyptomania, which was quite orientalist in nature. And therefore, what I try to argue is that Nefertiti helped propel the use of eyeliner in the Western world throughout the 1900s, starting in the 1920s, and that today, 100 years later, she remains as transfixing and beguiling as she once was, and people still emulate her look, knowingly or unknowingly.
You also debunk, if it still needs debunking, the notion that eyeliner is for women. In your research, men have used it for centuries, haven't they?
They have indeed. And actually, starting in ancient Egypt, both men and women wore coal. You would be hard-pressed to actually find an unlined eye of any ancient Egyptian in representations of ancient Egyptians. And that goes back to the idea that I said that it wasn't all about beauty. The range of uses made it such that eyeliner would be used by people of all classes and of different genders. And this was because it was an inherent part of their culture that was very important in their daily lives. And we see that same treatment of coal across different cultures in Asia and Africa and the Middle East today, and of course beyond. But the reason that I start with the Global South is because there is an understanding in these cultures that coal is not simply makeup. It is an expression of one's culture, one's religiosity, one's spirituality. It's a way to protect yourself from the evil eye. So in that sense, people are not thinking of it as sort of a preoccupation with beauty. They're thinking of it as a preoccupation with one's culture and sort of a daily honoring of that culture and heritage.
Your research took you to Japan, where you spent some time with geishas and found out that their makeup is interpreted in a very different way. How so?
Certainly. The geisha community is quite fascinating, really, because eyeliner for them is an indispensable component of their traditional aesthetic. So to ensure that they stand out, geishas will meticulously apply makeup onto their faces using classic Japanese hues, white for that very thick foundation on their face, a very, very deep black eye for definition, but as well as those two colors, they use a striking red that is often sourced from safflower petals to accentuate the eyes. It was interesting to observe that intersectionality whereby, for example, as I said, in ancient Egypt, they used eyeliner partly to protect against the evil spirits. In a totally different context, in ancient Japan, they were also using a form of red makeup around the eyes to protect against the evil spirits.
Zara, I'm curious, after all your research, for this book, did it have an impact on how you wear kohl or eyeliner? Did you kind of come upon a new style based on what you learned, or do you wear eyeliner the same way you did before you did the book?
Certainly, when I was writing the chapter on Amy Winehouse, my wings were growing bigger and bigger and bigger by the day. And I actually had no idea that that was happening. And at one point, I think I did a Zoom call with someone and I looked at myself and I realized that the wings were so, so heavy. And people on the street would stop me and say, "Has anyone ever told you you look like Amy Winehouse?" And I realized it was because of the wings. That's how much I immersed myself in Amy Winehouse and her aesthetic.
And when you say wings, you mean where the eyeliner kind of leaves the frame of the eye and moves beyond out along the temples?
Precisely that, yes. With Amy Winehouse, they kind of take on a life of their own, I'll say. So I like to say that my aesthetic is ancestral chic, whereby I'm wearing kohl on my waterline, and then I'm wearing liquid liner on my lids. So I have a little bit of Nefertiti, and I've got a little bit of Amy Winehouse as well. But importantly, I will always have kohl on.
Journalist Zara Hunkier there, speaking with the world's Carol Hills about her new book, Eyeliner, A Cultural History. That's where we leave you today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online anytime you need at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We all get over this week's hump tomorrow. We'll see you then. A quick note before we go. We are in the middle of our fall fundraising drive and need your help. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us. If we are able to raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. Every gift counts towards our goal. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.